Hello and welcome to The Psych Files. Michael Britt here, and this is episode number 41, entitled EMDR, The Other Side of the Story. All right, well, welcome, and just a couple of announcements before I get into this week's episode. One is I put up a new video on the website, just a simple one entitled, What is the Psych Files? So for anyone who visits the website and wants to get a better sense of what the Psych Files is all about, there's a little video that shows you how to use the various ways of navigating around the site, the concept maps and the categories and the cloud tags, etc. Hopefully these different ways of navigating the site will help you find the podcasts with topics of interest to you. So that's in the top right-hand corner, a link to that called What is the Psych Files? All right, and again, once again, just wanted to mention that, I'm very proud and happy that the Psych Files, going strong at episode 41, is endorsed by Pearson Education, the college textbook publisher and publisher of the fine psychology textbooks. And in fact, we're going to have an interview today. This is an interview episode with one of those textbook authors. Let me tell you how this came about. Quite serendipitous, actually, how all this happened. Perhaps you remember there was an episode last year, now about in the early summer, I think it was, episode number 19, which was an interview with a practitioner of EMDR, eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. Now, she explained how this therapy worked. I think she did a wonderful job. It was a very interesting interview if you're interested in this kind of therapy. So time went by, and you know the episode was getting a lot of hits. Everyone was interested in it. And then I got an email. Enter Benjamin Witz, a doctoral student from Minnesota State University, who said in an email to me that, you know, while he enjoyed the episode, he really would have liked it if I had discussed the controversy surrounding EMDR and reflected some of the views of its many critics. Now, you know, I responded to him that in preparation for the interview, I had looked into a number of sources and found that many people were largely supportive of EMDR. However, I certainly was willing to look into the critics and see what they had to say. So he gave me a name. He said, for example, have you looked at what Dr. Scott Lilienfeld has to say about this? And, you know, I said, all right, let me take a look into that. And I have to say, I was surprised at the controversy that surrounds this treatment. And but it was very interesting. It's interesting from a number of perspectives. At any rate, I was attending a meeting this past weekend. You know, I had copied out some of the articles, some of the opinion pieces, some of the research, and I will in a couple of episodes after this one present some of that research and just go to take a look at it, in part just to explore research and critical thinking and how psychologists review other people's research and what they look for, what's there, what isn't there, that kind of thing. I think that'll be interesting, helpful in particular perhaps to psychology students, but to anyone just to, you know, interested in critical thinking. But anyway, there I was, as I said, I had this research all printed out and I was taking a flight to San Francisco where the meeting was. And reading the research and underlining, et cetera, in preparation for this upcoming episode. And I attended a meeting. I got to the meeting, attended a session. And sure enough, out of the blue, Dr. Lilienfeld was also there. And he was introduced. And he was there to promote his brand new introductory psychology textbook. And I'm sitting there and I thought, oh my gosh, I don't believe this. There he is. And the author of these articles I had just been reading. So after the session, I went up to him, and of course, as any good podcaster will, I had my recording equipment with me in the hotel room. So I said to him, look, can I grab you for half an hour and just ask you about some of these articles you've written, some of which were a little bit old. One of them that in particular we're going to talk about here, it was from 1996. So I asked him, listen, would you be willing to summarize your position then? Tell us if any of your attitudes have changed about EMDR. So we have a unique opportunity to talk to one of the critics of EMDR and see what he has to say. So let's hear about the other side of the story regarding EMDR. What is it that concerns these critics about this type of psychotherapy? Okay, let's go to the interview. Dr. Lilienfeld, I appreciate your time.
Pleasure to be here.
Great. I've talked a bit in a previous episode about the treatment of eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And I've been in the process of doing some research on the topic to see what's being said. And what I'm finding out is that a lot is being said.
That's an understatement.
It's pretty amazing. A simple search on the term, well, on the terms EMDR and controversy brings up a slew of articles in just on Google and Google Scholar. And then I've been into the library at Marist College and found other articles. So since we've got the opportunity to talk with you, and you have been, I don't know, would you have called yourself outspoken on the issue? 10 years ago?
Right. I'd say I've done a little bit less writing on it recently, but back in the mid to late 90s, I was sort of viewed a bit as something of a critic or skeptic of a lot of claims being made on behalf of EMDR.
Okay. And in particular, I'm looking at an article that you wrote for the Skeptical Inquirer, the magazine that's still out today.
Right? Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Still is published.
Michael Shermer, I think, is that.
Actually, Michael Shermer edits a magazine called Skeptic, which is related to it. The editor of Skeptical Inquirer is someone named Kendrick Fraser.
Are these two?
No, they're actually parallel magazines and parallel organizations.
Okay.
Although I think increasingly friendly and starting to collaborate on some ventures.
You'd hope so. I think they both have podcasts.
Oh, yeah. No, they're very similar goals and very, very similar ideals, I think.
Okay. All right. So back in this article in 96 called EMDR Treatment, Less Than Meets the Eye, you know, you raised some very convincing arguments about the technique, some concerns that you had about there being, alternative explanations for the research results, not enough explanation for why the treatment does work. Mm-hmm. So maybe first tell us a little bit about that then. What is it about the treatment that you're concerned about?
Right. Well, I think what often concerns me and some of my colleagues when it comes to treatments like EMDR is less so much the treatment itself and more the claims being made on its behalf. I think we have to be really careful when we're dealing with psychotherapies that we not overstate the evidence for effectiveness, because I think by doing so, we really do our clients, and after all, that's what we're here to serve. We're here to serve people with mental health problems who are suffering and in distress. I think we do them a grave disservice when we make claims that go beyond the evidence. With regard to EMDR, actually, I think there's increasing evidence that it is effective for certain conditions, particularly post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD.
That's civilian PTSD?
Yeah, primarily, there's not as much evidence, although I think it's growing, on combat-related PTSD, civilian PTSD, which may be due to things like rape, for example. That's one of the most common causes of civilian PTSD. There, the evidence, I think, is pretty strong that it does have some effectiveness. So that's the positive side. The negative side is that there's not good evidence, and I pointed this out in the 96 article that you referred to, and I think there's actually more evidence now, that it works just about as well as a host of other procedures that therapists use that are often called exposure-based methods. And by exposure-based methods, what we mean are treatments that expose individuals to the stimuli, oftentimes the images, memories, thoughts that frighten them. So if they've undergone a terrible experience, like a rape or a combat trauma, exposure therapy will expose them repeatedly to images, thoughts, memories of those terrible events until the anxiety that is brought on habituates, to use a less technical term, wears off. In essence, what you're looking for in exposure-based treatments is for the anxiety to first peak and then pass. Peak and pass.
Is it paired? Is it like systematic desensitization in that you're pairing it with relaxation?
No, you're not. That's a good question. There's a class of exposure-based methods that systematic desensitization being one of the better known ones that does try to pair that with a pleasant stimulus, or at least a relaxing stimulus, the rationale there being what's often called classical conditioning. People familiar with that with Pavlov's dogs, where you pair one stimulus, oftentimes a pleasurable one, with another stimulus. But EMDR does not work that way. You're just exposing people to the memories, images, thoughts that they've had. And frankly, a group of therapists that are called behavior therapists that often tend to focus on basic learning principles, mm-hmm. have been doing these exposure-based methods for decades. And it's, in many respects, it's really kind of old hat.
And so exposure, you just have people imagine or relive the event, and the theory there is that by repeatedly reliving it, it loses its power to make
right. That's one way of putting it. That's right. Mm-hmm.
So if you're afraid of heights, we take you to the top of a building.
Exactly.
And sort of wait.
That's
until
right.
The
anxiety passes, mm-hmm. by habituates and passes. An example from my own clinical background. I once did quite a bit of treatment with individuals with a different anxiety disorder called obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. Some of your listeners are probably familiar with OCD. And I had one client who was very afraid of contamination, which is one very common source of fear among patients with OCD. So he would chronically wash his hands over and over and over again, and was very afraid that he'd get contaminated by dirt. So he'd be very afraid of walking outside. He'd be afraid of passing through doorways. He'd be afraid of shaking hands. He was extremely impaired. Mm-hmm. And was also very embarrassed to talk about it. But it got to the point where he was really virtually unable to function in daily life. That's how severely impaired he was. He couldn't read a magazine. He could not pick up the telephone because he was afraid of getting germs. So what did we do in his case? We used exposure therapy. That was a very stressful thing for him, and we had to talk him through this and explain to him the rationale for it, explain to him what was going to happen, get his permission, let him know this was going to be very stressful at first. So we would, in essence, contaminate him. So, for example, we took things that he was afraid of, so we worked this through with him. One thing he was very afraid of was laundry detergent.
Detergent, is it?
And that may seem ironic, right? Because detergent cleans things. Yeah. But one of the things, laundry detergent, of course, as you all know, is once you start pouring it, there are millions and millions of little grains. And, of course, he was very concerned that these grains would get on his skin and get into his skin and so on. So in one session, for example, we, with his permission, but it was very stressful for him. We put laundry detergent on his hands and then put a glove over it. I did not let him remove his glove. And then we tracked his anxiety.
Through by asking him.
Yeah, mostly by self-report.
1 to 10, how anxious.
Exactly, right. Some people use what's called a SUDS rating, subjective units of distress rating, kind of on a 0 to 10 or 1 to 10 scale. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, at first, his anxiety was 10, 10, 10. And in some of these cases, as with him, the exposure sessions may have to last hours. The very first sessions that we did, I think, were often 3 to 4 hours long because it took that long before the anxiety began to pass. It peaked and peaked and peaked and stayed up there for a very long time. And then eventually it got to 9 and then 8 and then it might be another half hour. And then by the end, maybe after a couple hours, he was saying, this is getting kind of boring. And that's when I knew we had succeeded in that session because he was starting to get kind of bored. And I said, well, that means you're not anxious anymore. And he sort of said, I guess you're right. I'm not anxious anymore.
So you sat with him for that period of time.
Correct.
With the glove and
yep.
just talked.
Yep, just talked him through it. Uh-huh. Yep.
Now, would he be concerned that the symptoms of whatever he might have just caught would show up a couple days later? Was he, you know?
Well, they do. And so it's not as though that's a cure-all.
No, I mean, was he worried that he might catch a cold?
Oh, yes. He was worried about everything. He was worried. He was terrified that this would contaminate him. This would cause some problems. And so, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
But he experienced that did not occur.
Correct.
Which is part of the truth.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's exactly right. But usually what happens, and this happened in his case, is when we got to the second session, a couple of days later, he was better than he was the first time, but his anxiety was still high. So it was he was nowhere near cured, but he did come down maybe 5 or 10% after the first session, then maybe another 5-10% of the second session. And then by the end, after a couple of weeks, we got him to the point, he was by no means cured, but we got him to the point where he could read a magazine again. And he was a very intelligent individual, actually, very intellectually curious. He wanted to read papers. He wanted to read the magazine. He wanted to talk to friends on the telephone. He was able to do these things. He was still impaired, mm-hmm. but he was able to do these things. Now, that's what's called in vivo exposure, in real life exposure. In post-traumatic stress disorder, more typically what you would do is use imaginal exposure in people's imagination. So you would, for example, get them to try to remember the terrible experiences that they underwent. If they saw the planes hitting the towers on 9/11, as some people did, bring them back to that time, get them to reimagine what happened. Now, some people do mixtures. Some people, for example, if it happened on 9/11, they may actually show them the tapes of the planes hitting over and over again, which is a little bit of a mixture. But in PTSD, typically, you will see that kind of imaginal exposure being done. And it again, is rarely a cure, but it can be a quite effective treatment for many cases of PTSD. Now, EMDR also is an exposure-based treatment. It's not marketed that way typically, but oftentimes in EMDR, there's a great deal of imaginal exposure to the images, to the thoughts, to the memories of the events over and over again while the client is tracking the therapist's finger movements with their eyes. What the research increasingly shows is that, at least for PTSD, in particular civilian PTSD, as we mentioned earlier, EMDR does seem to work better than no treatment at all. Mm-hmm. It probably works better than what we might term a control treatment, like just relaxation or just talking informally to a therapist, but it does not seem to work any better than a traditional exposure-based treatment like imaginal exposure. There seems to be no evidence at all that I have seen, and there have been what have been called not merely control trials comparing EMDR with other treatments, but also what are called meta-analyses. Meta-analysis is, in essence, a mathematical procedure for combining a large number of studies, pulling them together and mathematically treating them as though they're one study. These meta-analyses similarly seem to show several things. They seem to show that EMDR works better than no treatment. They seem to show that EMDR works as well as any other exposure-based treatment. And also, they seem to show that the eye movements of EMDR, which are presumably the distinctive, if not unique, feature of the treatment, do not contribute to its effectiveness. How have people found that out? Well, in a number of studies, people have compared EMDR, which again involves lateral eye movements, with a fixed eye movement condition where the procedure is kept constant, except the client, for example, stares ahead at a stationary dot without moving their eyes at all. And the studies show no difference at all in effectiveness.
So it's this issue of the eye movements that's key here, and I haven't heard a really good explanation. I mean, I've heard the similarity to REM, but that...
That's specious, really. That's really not... The eye movements really are different from that in REM sleep. They really are. And they don't really simulate the typical back-and-forth eye movements of REM. The similarities are really quite superficial. And even with REM sleep, the evidence is very controversial about whether or not it really facilitates memory. There's very mixed evidence on that. Other people have claimed that EMDR may work by synchronizing the two hemispheres. First of all, if that's true, we don't know. And if it is true, why it would necessarily result in clinical improvement is not clear. After all, in some clinical conditions like epilepsy, the problem is too much synchronization of the hemispheres. Hence, the reason for what's often called a split brain operation, where people will sever the two hemispheres in very, very desperate cases of epilepsy in a last-ditch effort to prevent the hemispheres from communicating with each other. Mm-hmm. So it's not clear to me why synchronizing the hemispheres would result in clinical improvement, let alone in treating the symptoms of PTSD.
So that seems to be a major issue then. It's the theoretical basis for this. It seems like the similarity, the claim that there's a similarity with REM sleep seemed like a search for some kind of explanation. And if that doesn't work, then maybe the explanation is right in left hemispheres and reprocessing. Unlike exposure, where you have that history that goes all the way back to Pavlov, there's a rational explanation for why exposure works. And I guess the thing with EMDR is we're still trying to figure out why.
I would say it's what psychologists sometimes perhaps cynically refer to as an explanation in search of a phenomenon. If there was evidence that EMDR along with the eye movements did better than a control condition without eye movements, then you'd have a phenomenon there to explain. But given that the eye movements do not seem to contribute to its effectiveness, there's no need to explain what the effects of the eye movements are. Mm-hmm. So to the extent to which EMDR is effective, I think the most parsimonious, the simplest explanation that accounts for the data is probably that EMDR works by exposure. One of the classic principles in scientific thinking, that's one we discussed in a new introductory psychology text that a few of us have just written, is called Occam's Razor, named after Sir William of Occam, which is that in general in science, a good guideline to use, not a perfect rule, there's no perfect rule, but a good general guideline that works in most cases is that if you have two explanations that account for the data equally well, you generally want to go with the simplest explanation. And in the case of EMDR, I would argue that the literature shows convincingly that the simplest explanation, the most parsimonious explanation, the explanation best supported by the evidence, is that to the extent that EMDR works, it is working because it is relying on the same basic learning principles of exposure that therapists have been using for decades. The other complaint I have about EMDR, again, is not so much the treatment itself or the theoretical rationale, but some of the extraordinary claims being made on its behalf. Another basic principle of science, again, one we discussed in our introductory psychology text, I believe it was first uttered by Marcello Trucci, who was a well-known skeptic for a time, is that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. It was actually popularized very much by the late astronomer and science writer Carl Sagan, who was also fond of that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So what Trucci and Sagan meant by that is if you're going to make some very extreme claims, some very extravagant claims, then they have to be matched by equally strong evidence. Mm-hmm. Sometimes some claims in psychology and other areas of science are extraordinary, and they turn out to be correct. There are cases of that, of course. But if we're going to make an extraordinary claim, we better damn well be able to support it. In the case of EMDR, I would argue some of the claims that have been made are really quite extraordinary. It has been talked about as a breakthrough treatment. In fact, the title, the subtitle of a major book on EMDR, co-written by its developer, was EMDR, the Breakthrough Treatment for Anxiety. It has been referred to as a paradigm shift in the treatment of anxiety. It has been used and continues to be used. In fact, I just recently heard a case of this being used for a host of conditions that go well beyond what it was initially designed to treat, like eating disorders, for example, like some of the distress associated with schizophrenia. It's even been used for medical conditions to alleviate the pain and distress associated with cancer and so on. These are pretty serious conditions, and these are people who clearly need high-quality help, psychological help based on the best available scientific evidence. To claim that EMDR, for example, can help treat eating disorders when there is virtually no controlled evidence whatsoever that's effective for that is an extraordinary claim. Is it matched by the evidence? In my view, no, it's not. And I think it is, in my view, very questionable at best to be promoting a treatment like this to be used for conditions for which it has not been validated. I suppose someone could argue, and it's not totally impossible, that in many of these eating disorders there is an anxiety component, which of course is true. There is an anxiety component to many eating disorders, including anorexia. Of course, there's a fear of gaining weight and so on. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility it could be effective, but it's a pretty extraordinary claim given there's no research on it. And at this point, it's entirely conjectural, entirely speculative. And again, to go beyond evidence in that way is really doubtful. I think too often in our field we focus, and I've seen this trend sometimes in writing on therapies, too often we focus only on the treatment itself, which is important, but we often don't focus on the way the treatment is being marketed and promoted to people in the general public. That's also really important as well.
Why is that important? I mean, if it works, why should I be worried about how it's marketed?
Yeah, if it works, yeah, right. If it works, but even the word "works" is a complicated one because it may not work as well as the practitioners say it does, and it may not work for the conditions the practitioners say it works for. So I think it's very important because, after all, we're here to help our clients. We're here to help the general public. That is our mission, and if we overstate the evidence for our claims, if we market treatments for conditions for which they're not supported, if we exaggerate the evidence for claims, then we're really doing our clients and the general public a disservice because they may seek out treatment for conditions for which it's not deserved. They may expect much more help than they get, and they may end up forsaking treatments that could be even more effective. And in the long run, it hurts and potentially harms them. And it also, I think, undermines the public's trust in us and our credibility as mental health professionals. When we go around making extravagant claims that aren't being supported by evidence, I think some people in the general public, and there are a lot of critics of us, as if we have to be aware of that, there are a lot of people in the general public who will say, oh, there's a lot of pop psychology. I mean, after all, a lot of the general public does not see a very clear demarcation between scientific and pop psychology. Now, we may, because we're in the world of academia, we do research, and we're aware of these distinctions, but we have to realize that a lot of people see psychology as Dr. Phil and Dr. Laura and John Bradshaw. And if we are not responsible in terms of the claims we make, and we do not model good scientific thinking and really appropriate scientific assertions for the general public, then we're really hurting ourselves in terms of our credibility for the public. And in the long run, we may be harming the very people that we're there to help.
Well, I really do appreciate your time on this.
It was my pleasure. I enjoyed it very much, Michael.
All right. Well, there you go. Dr. Lillian Fell, appreciate your time. So I thought he presented the position really quite well. I've got links to some of his websites and some of the sources that he mentioned. I'll have them on the blog. And then in a couple of podcasts hence, I'll take a look at some of the research and give you some of my thoughts on the topic as well. Feel free to stop by at the podcast website, blog, www.thepsychfiles.com, and leave a comment. If you have a position on EMDR, I'd love to hear it. So just click on the old comment link there and feel free to leave a comment. Send me an email. We'd love to hear from you. All right, thank you so much. Have a good week. This is Michael Britt here. See you next time on the Psych Files, and have a good week.